Okay, thank you for doing this interview.
Okay.
Can you tell me your name and spell it as well?
I am Grayson Perry, GRAYSONPERRY, and I was born on the 24th of March, 1960.
And where did you live in Leytonstone?
I lived at number 14 Dyers Hall Road, I think it was 14.
Right, and when did you move to the area?
I think it must have been January 1986, I reckon. Maybe, yeah, 86, maybe 87 though. Can't remember.
And she was, who are you? You were renting at the time?
I was renting from Acme Housing Association.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a pretty derelict property. And I was a bit shocked after living in Camden for 4 years to be oosted out to E17 or wherever it was. And it felt like the end of the world to me. And it was a horrible little house. But needs must, because I never had anywhere else to live. And, it, you know, it had enough room for studio, so that was fine. I was going to move in there with my girlfriend, but we split up, so I ended up there moving in there on my own.
But that you say it was little.
Well, little comparatively. It was about the size of this place.
Right.
So it was... But I've been living in a great big Georgian squat in Camden, which was like four stories and huge.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt, you know... It wasn't that I had more space personally, it just felt a bit more grander.
Mm.
This was just a little Victorian terrace that had the back windows bricked up and was incredibly bad condition. And I think Acme gave me like 250 quid, which was meant to cover putting in all plumbing and gas and electricity. So you can imagine how crude it was. Although I ended up with gas fire, hot water and enough power and stuff for it to work. So yeah, it kind of... It functioned, but it wasn't what you call cosy.
Yeah, yeah. But you didn't make any alterations to it other than the normal.
Oh, heavens. No, I might have painted it white and that would be about it.
Right.
It was a grim little place, really. It wasn't very nice.
Right. But in terms of, did you, you say you sort of lived in there and you worked in there, because a lot of it is a live-work space, isn't it?
Yeah, that was the deal with Acme, you know, when they gave you a house. It was, you know, there was no... deadline on how long you'd get it for, but I mean, I wouldn't have, and they must have given me at least 3 or 4 years thinking, you know, which seemed forever at that point in my life. And it was incredibly cheap rent. I can't remember what the rent was. Not very much though. Probably less than 30 quid a week, I should think. And I had the front downstairs room as my studio, which was a very small little front parlour with a bay window. And I bought a kiln, my first kiln that I owned, because I had been working at Battersea Arts Centre in the basement there, but that was very unsatisfactory. There's no natural light. They did have kilns, but... it had no privacy or security, so pieces of my work went missing, and it wasn't very nice working in a dank basement with people walking through all the time.
I didn't know they had
studio spaces. I don't know if they doubt that, they've still got it now, but this was, you know, in the mid-80s. A friend of mine was working there and she sort of got me in, and you know, it stopped a gap for a while. I think I worked there for about a year or two. It was the first place where I had kind of control of the kilns, and I sort of, you know, learned a bit about firing and stuff. But then I bought my own little dustbin, you know, you can buy these cheap, lightweight, sort of drum-shaped kilns for relatively little money. And they work fine, they're brilliant, you know. They do the job. And that was my kiln for the next 3 or 4 or 5 years, yeah.
For the period of time that you were...
I was in... the period of time I was in Dyers Hall Road, that was my kiln. And, it worked. But, I think I only lived there full-time for about a year and a half. How long was it? I'm trying to think. Yeah, I think it was like the next. So I think it must have been January 87 I moved in. Mm-hmm. January 87, because I moved up to London January 83, 3 years in the squats. We got kicked out on my birthday, I remember. And then I lived for a year next door. And then, so that would have been January 87 I moved in. And I lived there full time until about spring 88 when I moved in with my now wife, who lives in Georgian Splendour in Clerkenwell, so it's much nicer.
But you kept it as a studio, did you?
I kept it as a studio for until longer I lived there, until it came to an end, which was must have been 93.
All right, it's quite a while.
Yeah, so yeah.
And but when you rented, were you...
motorbike, that's how I divide time up. I always divide time what motorbike I had, because that's how I can remember, because I know exactly how long I had each motorbike. And I've just sold my Harley, my first Harley, so that would have been 93. And then I moved pretty soon after that to the next studio, so that would be 93 I moved.
How many motorbikes did you have when you were in the area?
Three different ones. Four. Five, I think. I went through a lot then, because I was in my golden period, because I was doing a lot of mileage. It was when I kind of started to have enough money to buy a decent motorbike while I was there, because I was starting to make relatively... I mean, I used to plough a huge proportion of my money into motorcycles at that time. So... I bought my first, I had a ratty Yamaha 250, and then I bought a BMW Twin, which was my first proper big motorbike, and then I had a Suzuki sports bike, which was very, very fast, but I was going to kill myself if I kept it, and then I went on to Harley Davidson's after that. So, that's how I divide my time up, is motorcycle ownership, and we've just entered another phase of this.
Still in the Harley Davidson era, or not?
Yeah, still in the Harley Davidson era, but I'm on my fourth one now.
Mm-hmm. Pretty impressive. But were you aware at the time when you took on the houses that the area was, that it was blighted, and that it was...
Oh God, yeah. I mean, it was. Look at the street. You know, it was. You could tell just by looking at the houses that they were owned, when you see sort of bits of old blanket pinned up in the window. I mean, the curtainage is the most telling social marker, isn't it? Mm-hmm. A bit of old blanket, squatter, hippie, neck curtains, working class, blinds, middle class. It's very easy to tell from outside a house. So that's a general rule, of course. But you could tell. And also, I remember there was that sort of area that had sort of corrugated iron halfway down the street. And it had homes, not studios, painted on it, which made me feel very welcome.
Yeah. I was going to say, actually, what was the relationship like between sort of what were considered the local artists and the local community? Was there...
I don't know. I mean, I knew a few people in the area. An ex-girlfriend of mine lived just down the road. And various people I knew were sort of scattered about. But it felt just like a long way, because, my gallery was always in the centre of town. It always felt like all my friends and stuff were scattered about at that point. I felt quite sort of... it's the first time I'd lived on my own. I didn't like it. Mm. Felt very bleak and lonely, and just sort of shuffling over to the co-op. And I didn't have much money, and it felt, yeah, because I any spare money I had, I ploughed usually into my motorcycle at that point.
Mm-hmm. And what at that time, before you moved into the area, what sort of work were you producing?
Well, pots, and they just gradually got better. nothing that ambitious. I mean, the largest pot I'd made up to that point was like, you know, 50, 60 centimetres in any direction, not very large. Not particularly elaborate. I had a much higher production rate in those days. You know, those days I was producing maybe between 50 and 80 pieces a year. But they didn't take that long. You know, they were relatively simple compared to now where I produce between 10 and 20.
Mm.
Because they take forever. You know, I was willfully obscure and pretentious like most young artists, you know. I was looking at some of my old work last night, actually. It made me cringe a bit, some of it. But, you know, I had a lot of... I mean, basically, I'm making the same work now I ever made. You just refine it, you know. I'm not worried about being original. Mm. I think that's a blight on the art world, originality. And then, you know, when I got my own kiln, I could start to have more control. So, you know, you learn how a kiln works and you learn its foibles and you start to refine, because ceramics is all about sort of predicting how it will come out. So when you have your own kiln, you can start to predict the behaviour of certain glazes and clays and such like. So you become more refined in the finished result. You know, I'm not a potter who likes the happy accident or the gift of the fire, as they call it. I prefer it coming out like I wanted it to.
And in terms of things like the images and so on, where were you sourcing those from at the time?
Probably too much from my head. Now I tend to have reference material for nearly everything. One's imagination is limited, though. I mean, you only have to look at fantasy art to realise that, how limited the human imagination is.
Because if, you know, a lot of your, well, I can't say everything, but actually use sort of imagery, whereas some of your earlier pots that I've seen, you're actually much more about you sort of marking into it yourself.
I still use a lot of drawing. But partly it's down to, you know, the fact that now I have the skills and knowledge to access different sorts of imagery, you know, and also a budget. Yeah. Pottery is pretty cheap to produce if you just do basic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the earthenware pots, a few oxides, a bit of glaze, pretty cheap. Now, when you start getting into elaborate glazes, lustres, and digital transfers like these are, you know, getting much more expensive. So, and the technology didn't exist then, you know.
Mm.
But I was using a lot of what they call open stock transfers, which are like from a factory on Stoke-on-Trent. You just buy off-the-shelf kitsch imagery, you know, like kittens and flowers and popes and country cottages, that kind of stuff. So I use those a lot. And so I did a lot, you know, I did a lot of pots and was relatively experimental. And I had several shows, you know, while I was there. I mean, I was with James Birch Gallery, who then became Birch and Conran Gallery about the time that I moved to Leytonstone. So I had a show in 87, 88 and 90 in Soho.
One solo shows?
Yeah. And each show had about 60 to 80 pieces in, so it was quite, I was pretty prolific there in terms of numbers, if not quality, I don't know. But all pottery then. I mean, now pottery only makes up about half my production. Relatively unrefined compared to now. And a lot more kind of, you know, basic gaffes in it. But, you know, people used to think that I deliberately did it like that. No, I was just a net, because I'm mainly self-taught. I didn't learn ceramics at college.
Right.
I learned a bit at evening classes, then I just winged it from then on and just thought about what effect I wanted and found out a way of doing it.
Mm. When did you take the evening classes?
Between 83 and 6, probably.
Mm.
And yeah, I probably did it for about 2 to 3 years. But it was very frustrating because you're always communal firing, so you never get the kiln firing suited to your work, so it tends to be either under or over fired all the time, which is really frustrating. So it's not a great system for the artist who actually wants to make work. But it was, you know, it filled a gap, it did the job. You know, I always sold work. I've never had any problem selling work, even but the trouble of them, and that was because I was ridiculously cheap when I started. You know, my first show, the work was £30 to £80, and I don't think it went that much up for the second. You know, by the time I was at Dyers Hall Road, I think I was selling pots for around £300 to £400.
And were you selling the complete show out, do you reckon?
No, I'm probably selling about 50% because that's, I think, good. The variable quality.
Yeah.
I think partly. A lot of the work got the... There was a big pile of broken shards in the back garden.
Right.
A lot of it got the golden honour of the hammer. Yeah, my next door neighbour, Anita and Mark, they... I used to collect them. I think they've got them. They've got a mosaic of them. I think they still live in the area, I think. They've got a mosaic pavement, I think, made out of bits of my pots. As a studio, it kind of worked. I didn't need much room because I make small things.
But when you had 80 pots in there, it must have been pretty...
I got to the point where I would move, you know, I'd take them to James Birch would come and collect them, you know, at a certain point and put them in the store cupboard in the gallery or something. I never had more than about 20 in the house at any one time. And it was much smaller work then. I mean, none of them would have been this big. So the storage wasn't so... I was still making a lot of plates. So at least half the show would be plates,
right,
which, you know, you can, you know, stack up. Yeah, they you know, fitted the boot of the cart, isn't it? So it wasn't a problem.
And had you been making films before that as well?
Yeah, my kind of filmmaking was already winding down by that point, right, because it cost so much to do. You know, even Super 8 filmmaking was relatively expensive compared to making pottery. And my heart wasn't... I saw that it was too competitive, and all female filmmakers seemed to talk about was how to get the money to make their next film. And I saw pottery... A, I could probably make... I sort of saw it as a source of income, and B, I saw it as a niche that I could occupy more, you know, with more freedom.
Mm.
You know, like the film... The film world was already, I felt, too... And I say film as opposed to video, in that video immediately kind of just that idea of installations, which is something I've never completely been interested in. You know, I was always making films as films that you sat down in the dark and watched, you know. Though, I mean, you know, we used to just pretend cinema. Yeah, and I look at my films now, and most of them are awful. God, awful. Boring. But they're, you know, they're an interesting record of my slightly drug-addled youth. Dyers Hall Road.
You sort of said one of the things I always think about that area is, now I look at the map, it's in zone 3, Leytonstone.
Oh, yeah.
And it sort of...
You'd never get a cab back to Leytonstone. Not even...
It's quite close. And I was thinking about, you know, you're talking about James Birch coming out to Leytonstone. It feels like it must have been sort of somewhere off the map almost.
Yeah. I mean, there was advantages of it because that was... I mean, 89 was when I started mountain biking. And of course, you had the forest on the doorstep. Yeah. So, you know, that was great. I could, within 5 minutes, I could be off road and go all the way up to Epping.
Mm.
So, it had its advantages, yeah. And I spent an awful lot of time up in Epping Forest, you know, hanging out with the bike on the, at the motorbike hut.
Yeah.
So that's what I used to do, you know, quite often, nearly every lunchtime, I would get on my motorbike and tootle up to the motorbike hut and sit in the sun and eat a ham roll and then come back and work. And, yeah, and there was a guy, I forget what his name was now, but he had a similar bike to me and we used to sort of ride about quite a lot. Sort of chug around.
But for your gallerist to come into that other sort of side of the world almost, must have been a strange thing for him.
Yeah, it was quite, it had a sort of, you know, it had a sort of artistic cred, I suppose, you know, because it was genuinely grim. It didn't have any quaintness about it. It's miles too far out ever to be truly gentrified.
Mm.
You know, the wave of gentrification is never going to reach Leytonstone, really. I mean, it might get better built, perhaps, and a little bit more prosperous, but it's never going to be middle-class London, really. It's, it might like to think it is. They might have two cars, but they're never going to be middle-class. It's the back of beyond. It's too far from the centre of town. Just that fact makes it... You know, anybody with any kind of cultural aspirations is either going to live in the middle or in the countryside. You are in true sort of... It's kind of urban suburbia. It's not nice suburbia, like leafy... lawny tree suburbia. It's quite grim suburbia, and of course it had that great big road then carved right the way through it, which didn't help. But it was quiet, I suppose, you know, quiet in some ways, apart from the screaming kids in the school, because you know, my house was sort of between the two sides of the school, so the girls would be walking past backwards and forwards the entire time. So what I remember is the noise of girls screaming in the day. That was very prominent.
Rather than a noise of the cars that used to sit on the roads around there, didn't they?
What, traffic jam?
Yeah.
What, down dial, what's the name of the road?
Road Green Road.
Green Road, yeah.
And who do you remember? There were other artists living in the area.
God, Gary Ragg, I think he was an artist I remember up the road. He remember because he married this, he was kind of noteworthy to me because he married a Muslim girl, I remember. And I thought, that's weird. And he'd sort of embraced Islam. And I thought, oh, sort of interesting. I think he grew a beard. I think he sort of strolled around like he seemed quite sort of patriarchal, which is quite odd.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, oh, it's funny, sort of taking on the whole role of the Muslim man. I thought that was interesting. You know, because normally when you have that sort of cultural clash, the partner will, you know, osmosis will happen from the less liberal culture, will go into the more liberal culture. But in his case, it was the other way around. He sort of seemed to embrace the sort of strictures I might be talking at the top of my head. He might be perfectly, you know, reasonable and open-minded about these things, but it seemed to be odd to me. Who else was in the area? Well, there's Karen Densham, who was a ceramicist next door. There was open studios fairly often. Right. We used to sort of wander around each other's houses and look at their art.
Nothing sort of formal, just informal.
No, they used to have like, I remember it was on a Friday evening a couple of times, and they would, you know, be a little map and you'd wander from house to house and look in people's houses. I can't really remember that strongly, there being like a community, because my community were all in sort of people I knew through Soho and the nightclub scene and things like that. I mean, it stopped me going to nightclubs, which was a shame. I think my nightclub going ended when I moved to Leytonstone because it was just too far. I mean, when I was in Camden, I could walk home, but there's no way I could get back to Leytonstone, so I very rarely went out to nightclubs. It's a bit of a pain.
I suppose Christine started to wind down the neo-naturist before then, do you
think? Yeah, I think the golden era of neo-naturism, it's still sort of puttering on to this day, but that's definitely the golden era. We still did the old, I don't think I really got involved much after that.
It felt like the economy of being an artist was actually quite different at that point, in a way.
The opportunity. I think there's just as many poor artists now.
But in terms of, the idea of having an opportunity to experiment and make mistakes, it seems to be more people come out thinking that they are.
Well, people think that art. People think art is a career now, don't they? Which we never did. You know, we did art because we like making art. Not because we wanted to be artists, which I think a lot of young people now, they're, oh, I'd like to be an artist. Mm. And I think that's a mistake, because most of being an artist is sort of sitting in a dirty little studio on your own with the radio on, plugging on, trying to sort of make something. It's not hanging out in groovy galleries, drinking free wine, no. Mm. So, there was it was a less glamorous world. I mean, we were already getting the first, I remember meeting Damien Hirst very early on, because James Birch knew his wife-to-be, meet Maya, who I knew as well from the mid-80s. And I remember meeting him very early on, but he was like, from the word go, he was sort of very celebrated from that first show. Yeah. I didn't go to that show he did called Freeze, but I think the first time I saw his work was when he was at the ICA. And then the whole sort of YBA phenomenon started to take off. But did that overlap with the period in Leytonstone? Kind of just, I suppose. Mm. Late 80s. Mm. Yeah.
Was it Freeze in 88?
Was it?
I think it was.
Yeah. So it would have overlapped, yeah. But it wasn't, I've got to know them all since, really. Rather, I wasn't really a part of it, because I didn't go to a London art school, and I was a little bit older than most of them, and I didn't hang out in their circles so much.
But it seemed to me that one of the things, the opportunity that, not just Acme in that area, Leytonstone, happened in obviously other areas, but one thing that gave people was the opportunity is there's a live workspace. To actually make mistakes, to actually experiment.
Yeah,
it was all that time, I suppose.
Yeah, you could actually make art without needing to make any money out of it. But that, I suppose now it's difficult. It's not so many. It's about cheap studio space. Mm. What it's all about is actually essential for an artistic community, because, especially at the beginning. I mean, for me, I sold work, but I never made enough money to live on.
Mm.
I mean, all this time that I was from 83 right the way through till, maybe like 80, the end of the 80, well, probably just when I moved in with my wife, 88, I think I stopped signing on then. But all that time I was signing on, or I did enterprise allowance scheme, I did the community project,
right,
which I did while I was still in Camden, actually. The community project where I was a local historian in Islington. And I did the enterprise allowance thing up in Leytonstone. So I did, I sort of struggled by, The money I made from my work was treat money. It wasn't, it couldn't be relied upon to put food on the table, really.
And there's quite a, I don't know how you felt about it, but there's quite a big sort of craft art divide as well at that point.
I don't know if it was just me in my head, but it did feel I think the divide was probably more on the side from the craftspeople than on the art people. You know, craftspeople might have felt excluded.
Yeah.
But I think art people were probably perfectly happy to dabble in crafts if they wanted to. I mean, I never felt any... but, you know, for me, the attraction of making pottery was always that it was seen as a bit of a naff thing to do, which has always been a motivating force for me, you know. If I start thinking something is naff, I start thinking it's got interest. Because the minute something is declared stylish, it's on its way down again, really. Mm. Art, craft, divide. I don't know if I mean, when I was coming out, you know, during the 80s and to a certain extent in the 90s, I exhibited a few times in a sort of craft context, and I always felt a bit uncomfortable doing it, but it gave me exposure in times when I didn't have it. You know, because I'd go whole years without an exhibition. And so I would take any offer that came my way, yeah, which included, you know, craft things. But now I avoid them because... I am an artist, and craftspeople on the whole seem to have a different attitude. It's something sort of slightly neutered about a lot of craft work, like it's been sort of domesticated.
Maybe it's a slightly different purpose? I don't know.
No, I think not a lot of craft work now is just sort of domesticated art, isn't it? It's not like it's... I mean, if it was traditional craft, I would like it better. You know, if it was all nice pottery and baskets and clothing and jewellery, that's fine. But it's when it ventures into trying to be sort of sub-art, that's when I kind of worry about it. I say, if you're going to make art, go the whole way. And compete with the art world. It's as if they're kind of like a little bit scared to come out, you know. So they're just going to kind of... It's like the big fish in a small pond thing, you know. And craft is like a lagoon. And the minute they come out of the lagoon, all the big scary sea of the art world. And so, you know, you've got to go out there and take risks, really. But, you know, craft is fine, but it's just got to be another thing. It's got to be an honesty about it and say, you know, I make art that people have liked put on their sitting room tables. That's fine. Just be honest about it. Don't make out that it's... part of the 21st century history of art. You know, it's a nice thing for your sitting room.
And then, but moving slightly different tangent, thinking about the M11. When did you first hear about the campaign that was going on?
I mean, we all knew why our houses were cheap to rent. You know, there was a whole line that went right the way down through lanes there. You knew why it was. You know, everybody that I kind of knew had sort of probably lived along some way to do with the fact that, you know, there was a strip running from, where was it, from sort of Wanstead right the way down to, from the sort of the North Circular all the way down, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And so we knew it, but... The first I can remember was, it was interesting because it was the first what I'd call the middle class protest.
Right.
You know, the NIMBYs of Wanstead came out, and there was that tree, wasn't there, on the green. I think that was that early on in the protest? Fairly early on, was it? I don't know. But I remember we had the Rose protest in, we had the Rose protest down in Hampshire first.
Yeah.
Because there was a whole wave of them.
Yeah, they had Twyford and...
Twyford Down, yeah, and I remember the sort of Battle of Twyford Down and all that, and it all seemed terribly good fun. And then there was like, was Swampy before or after?
Yeah, before.
Before. And then, of course, it started, and I thought, yes, and I liked the fact, you know, the tree decorating, it had that sort of shrine-like quality, and people living up a tree, and little old ladies defending the tree, and... I like the fact that suddenly you had this sort of very unusual alliance of people in a protest, and that was fun. And then, of course, you got started getting all the video cameras. It was the time of the cheap little portable video camera, and I think that was very noticeable. Every time you sort of saw a protest, the ground was littered with empty cassette boxes and film cartons. That was the ammunition of, you know, they would use that to sort of gather evidence against the police and sort of counter the... but then, actually, I thought the media on the whole liked the protest and they were on their side and sort of really enjoyed it because it was a great spectacle. And, you know, as it kind of grew in ambition, I mean, Dyers Hall Road, nothing much happened. We were all quite passive and lay down and let it come over us, I think, to a certain extent. I didn't want to jeopardise, to a certain extent, my next... Because I was already arranging for my next studio.
All right.
And I think Acme had sort of put pressure on us not to cause trouble and to leave when we were asked. And I already had arranged another studio, so I didn't want to piss them off because I had to have somewhere to work.
And that was another Acme?
That was a studio in Carpenter's Road.
Right, yeah.
Which is now under the Olympics.
Yes.
So, but I suppose, the epicentre was that road, what was it called? Just down the...
Claremont.
Huh?
Claremont?
Claremont Road, yeah.
But Dyers Hall Road was cut off as well, wasn't it, part of it?
Didn't it was cut off, yeah.
Did your house disappear, or was it on the...
Yeah, it did.
Right.
It was, it was just on the kind of where the wall is, I think. And I had plans of like doing fun. One of my plans was to somehow get hold of some human bones, like a human skeleton, and then make some sort of archaeological artifacts and like bury them in the garden. So when they come to demolish the house, they found this sort of archaeological site. So they had to stop the protest. That was my plan. I never did get hold of any human bones at the time to do that. But that was going to be my plan. I had a whole sort of thing, you know. Or I was going to pretend that some sort of murder victim had been buried there ritualistically or something and sort of stop the road. But I thought the whole... Yeah, I liked the aesthetic of the Rhodes protest. I remember I sort of took a few photos and used them in transfers on pops and things.
In terms of what they did sort of on Claremont Road, because there was something two aspects almost, so that's sort of quite graphic... element of what they produced in terms of newsletters and posters.
Yeah, I didn't really see that. It was just what looked the Claremont, like the big flags and the murals and all the sculpture and all the living rooms outside on the street and the car covered in grass and the nets in the trees and, of course, at the end, the big Dayglo tower with all the flags on. I mean, that was massive. It must have been like 60 foot high.
Yeah.
I was just like... And I went to my friend who lived on Grove Green Road and we watched the eviction through her back window, and it was like watching a medieval siege, you know, because it was a very hot day and there's all this dust coming up and all the policemen in their riot gear were crawling over the top of the all the houses, and it was just like a sort of Monty Python medieval scene, you know, with all the protesters with the mirrors flicking them into the policemen's eyes, and it was a comic thing. It was just quite... it was going on at the end of this woman's garden. It was hilarious. And yeah, see, it was fun, and you know, they had a good point. You know, do we need another bloody road? I mean, it does mean getting to work here is much quicker, mind.
I know, that's what everyone says.
Now I live in the centre of town, I commute out. You know, I use that road. I drive over my old house every day.
That's what everyone says. I protested against it, but I love it really.
Oh well, that's that for me proves, you know, the whole thing is that we're all going to hell in a handcar because. You know, I think the main thrust behind green issues these days is like a sort of, it's a great thing to attach middle class morality to.
Mm-hmm.
It's like kind of Victorian religion, you know, like when all the middle classes suddenly got very pious. But this in our 21st century version is, oh yes, we recycle and we carbon neutral or whatever. And I think, it's funny the people on the other side of the road who live in council houses don't do it. It's true though. A friend of mine lives on a street, you know, half council houses, half homeowners. Only one side of a street recycles.
But talking, you know, talking about the aesthetic and you liked it, there was the art house as well, wasn't there?
Yeah,
there?
Well, I was in that exhibition.
Didn't they do a number of exhibitions? Well, I don't know.
Well, I don't know if they did how many they did, but I had a... I did a part about the Rose Protest. It was quite a nice part. I had a picture of Bass on, I remember. I can't remember. It had a nice poem about the Rose Protest on it. About the area and it going. And they asked me if I wanted to be in the show. And it was, I was very laissez-faire about it. I said, sure, you know, cause I knew that the likelihood is that the pot would get nicked.
Mm.
And it did. I think it got nicked the night of the big poll tax riot.
Oh, yeah.
And they all came back to Claremont Road from there, I think.
It was about 1919,
I think. Yeah. And they nicked. So somebody out there, hopefully, has still got my pot. I'd like it back. And if it ever occurs at auction, my police will be down on it like a ton of bricks.
Well, they have an image of it anyway. At the Museum of Art.
Are they really?
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. On the shelf in that art house. Must be.
Yeah, it's just a single...
I painted a little shelf. I think I painted a little patch around the shelf and then put my pot on it.
Oh, right. I don't remember that. I just remember seeing it's really quite close up of a pot with but it's only got the text.
Yeah, there was a text right the way down, I think, as far as I remember. It's quite white, the pot. Quite one colour, is it?
Yeah, it's hard to tell.
Yeah.
But it's quite hard to read as it curves down the bottom. It sort of gets a bit unreadable. But
I was quite philosophical about it going because I thought, it's bound to. A friend of mine did a mural on the end house.
Oh, yeah.
Jennifer Binney. She painted a horse, I think, on the end house. On the end, on the gable end, mm-hmm. facing up towards Dinosaur Road. And there was a great big... One of the things I liked the best was the big Union Jack made out of sort of patchwork, which is an image I used a couple of times in pots.
Right.
I liked that very much. That sort of co-opting of symbols I thought was fun. But it's amazing how prescient in some ways it all was when we think of the whole sort of, you could hardly read a paragraph in a newspaper now without ecology, green environment in there somewhere. So it was ahead of its time in some ways.
Mm. But the work that you were making at that time, do you think it was at all informed by your locality, immediate sort of area? Or?
Yeah, I've always been informed by the area my studio is in. You know, I quite like having a studio in a grim place, as you know, here in a way. It's pretty grim. I've only got the sort of North Circulus 5 minutes walk away. I can go and I've done several pieces, I've gone out for a walk on an afternoon and I've been a bit sort of stuck and thought, I'll do piece about the North Circular. So I quite like that. I don't find the countryside very inspiring. Mm. Nature, boring. It's nice to go and visit, but it's boring to make art about. It's nice in itself. It's like making a piece of art by having a hot bath. It's a nice thing to do, I have a hot bath, but I'm not going to make a bit of work about it. Because having the bath is the nicest thing. So it's more interesting to make something beautiful about something ugly, I always think, like Leytonstone and that kind of particular tattiness of it all.
And do you think that any of your subsequent work has sort of made nods to the politics of that time and protests at all?
Yeah, probably, I still make things occasionally about I don't know what I make art about anymore. What do I make art about? I suppose it has informed. I don't know, not specifically. I haven't made a whole environmental campaigning. I think what's interesting about environmental issues is the fact that hardly anybody really wants to be inconvenienced by it.
Mm.
You know, loads of people are really, yeah, great idea, yeah, good. But nobody wants to give anything up, which is, you've got to do. There's no way around it. Sorry, you've got to travel less, or you've got to wear less, you know, you can't buy an outfit every week, sorry. You can't go on holiday, you know, whatever. But nobody seems willing to do that.
Mm. Do you think the protesters really ended up being about the environmental issue of building roads?
I think a lot of the people enjoyed the protest. Mm. They were protesters.
Yeah.
It's like when I give a talk, afterwards, are there any questions? And I kind of know that the people who will ask me questions are the people who like asking questions. They're not necessarily the ones who've got anything interesting to say. And I think a lot of the time people who do protests are people who like protesting,
mm.
rather than that they really feel against, you know, the thing. Because that's, you know, that process over content. You know, we are irrational animals.
Mm.
And we will, you know, rationalise our behaviour. And say, yes, I'm doing this for the environment. But really, they like a bit of a ruck, or they like kind of, you know, sitting around getting stoned all day and waving their homemade flags from the roof.
Yeah, it's about a lifestyle.
Yeah, there's a lot of lifestyle in that goes on. But, you know, I think there's probably, there are definitely some people who care about it, who organise it and everything. But I think without the kind of counterculture, youth culture element of it, I don't think it would be so popular. Mm. The minute you've got a kind of nice wristband to wear or something, you know, suddenly, oh, we all care. The minute you've got a rock concert to go to and care about the environment, and it's, people get excited. But when it's actually sort of say, just give me some money and then go away, no, it's not so interesting. Oh, but you can cycle across Cuba for the children. Fuck off.
So did you actually visit the protest site when it was on Claremont Road?
Oh yeah, quite a lot, because Christine was very involved in it, Christine Binney. So, you know, she used to, you know, I used to go with her, and she was quite into, there was a whole house full of kind of sort of hippie types that she used to became very friendly with on the corner with the Cat Hall Road, I think.
Right. Yeah.
I think it was in a house right on the corner, next door to where Mary Lemley was living, I think.
Grove Green Road?
Yeah, on Grove Green Road, on the corner of the Cattle Road, there was a couple of houses there. And I think there was this sort of very semi-feral family, I think they were like. And Christine became very friendly with them, and sort of like they were quite involved in it, and... yeah, I used to hang out with a few of the people, got to know them a little bit, I can't really remember. Yeah, I used to go down there and we used to drink in the North Coat, is it, occasionally. Yeah, it was fun, it was interesting to see it.
Mm.
On your doorstep. I was never a great protester though, yeah. I sort of... watch from the sidelines, really. I remember going to one along to the day they were all being evicted,
mm-hmm.
and sort of standing, sort of not pretty close to where they were, kind of confrontation. I just kind of like 20 yards back or something, and sort of like they're kind of watching the hoo-ha going on. It was funny. And they, you know, when they were trying to, they had the great big cranes trying to pick the guys from off the top of the towers and all that. And I thought, oh. Good. No, all power to them, you know, and but of course now we all drive over it.
Mm.
But I think those sort of protests did set a change, and we don't hear so many new roads being built now.
No, there was a policy afterwards, that was the last one to be built, wasn't it? Although I think they're reversing that policy now.
Probably, yeah, it's this new thing about planning, isn't it, that's going through tomorrow, I think. They're trying, isn't it, about reversing, about giving planning away, to making it sort of smoother by giving it over to sort of specialist juries rather than the public or something like that.
And did you get a sense of both positive and negative sides that came out from that?
What, from the road protest?
Yeah.
Well, I think you know, it was a very attractive, like I say, youth culture side to it. And also you started seeing the kind of middle class protesters, little old ladies and people, you know, waving banners about the, it was a nice simple environmental issue, you know, the demon car. And I suppose it was, you know, Mrs. Thatcher sort of said something like, you know, a 30-year-old man should be ashamed if he's just sitting on the bus or something.
Yeah.
Did she say something like that? Which I thought was pretty bad. So, you know, I think it probably started to define, you know, it started to shape the kind of nature of environmental protest, and that whole sort of theatre of protest that sort of come out of that, really. And they kind of, like, when they used to raid the transport minister's house and things like that.
I was going to ask you about the sort of the idea of that performance type.
Yeah, and I think that's fun because it's very disarming, you know, when it's theatrical rather than aggressive. Because I think aggression is self-defeating. You know, it's just like, well, no wonder you're getting hit over the head with the truncheon because you just threw a brick at them, you know. But if you're just dressed up in a funny costume and shouting, then it's like, oh, don't hit the nice man in the bunny suit. I think we might have gone on a road protest, actually. I think I can remember pushing my daughter along in a pushchair. Was there a big march at one point towards the end?
There were various things where it became slightly merged with the criminal justice bill.
Well, I wouldn't have been one to worry about that too much because I wasn't a great raver. I can remember going on some sort of march along the route of the M11, I think it was. Was there something like that?
Yeah, I think they used to come round by the Greenman roundabout.
Yeah, I remember walking up Leytonstone High Street at some point, pushing a pushchair with loads of people, making lots of noise.
Yeah, I think it's sort of lots of it, yeah, around that time was the Criminal Justice Bill, and a lot of the people at the protest were also part of the that, and Reclaim the Streets. And
oh, yeah, that was a good thing that came out of that. Reclaim the Streets, they were funny.
That's, again, another sort of very theatrical...
Yeah, and Critical Mass, I think, are they related to that at all? I don't know, probably not.
I don't think
so. But yeah, I don't think it had any lasting definite, did it? There's so many things going on in your life, isn't there? I like, yeah, for me, it was just interesting to see the creativity of it close up. Well, you know, I remember going around the guy who'd, like, built a kind of drawbridge, and it was practically sort of like something out of Indiana Jones he'd built in his house. You know, I thought, this guy just likes building things. You know, he's not really protesting about the roads. He's a kind of slightly mad guy. Because, you know, those sort of things, they're a perfect fit with the paranoid conspiracy theorist types. You know, and oh man, it's all on the internet, you should know about it. Yeah, their government, yeah, they're gonna, you know, take us over, turn us into zombies because, you know, Roswell was true, you know, mate. It's like, so religion, I suppose.
I think to a degree, yeah.
And,
it's a belief, anyway.
Yeah, belief system. And, yeah, as long as they're harmless, I'm all for it, you know, because it makes the rich tapestry.
So we talked a bit about the art house and...
I can't remember that much about it. All I can remember is just one day going down there, painting the wall and putting my pot in and then thinking, well, I won't see that again. I think we had an opening that evening.
Right.
Because, you know, you're dealing with semi-legal people. So that honesty is not necessarily high on their agenda when it comes to things. I mean, you know, I think it survived a couple of weeks without anybody nicking it, but... It went. All night of telly, that's quite nice. Like you do, I've moved on a bit from those days. Now I control what all you people watch.
And what you think in terms of politics by being on Question Time.
What do I think of what?
By what we think about politics by being on Question Time.
Well, I believe in participating in the debate, of course, yes. And I think the most shocking thing you can be in the art world is slightly conservative. So I'm all for that. Though I am... Politically, I'm probably left of the government, but I'm quite happy to pay tax.
Yeah, well,
but I wish it went to the right people.
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully it feeds back down, but it doesn't seem to. It seems to feed up. Anyway... But I was sort of interested also in the idea, just when I mentioned about the idea of locality feeding into your work.
Well, I am a person of the northeast quadrant.
Right.
You know, I have a theory that on the whole, in London, people are drawn in the direction from which they came. So if you came from Essex, you tend to end up in the northeast quadrant of London, and if you come from Hampshire, you're in the southwest quadrant. You know, that's my theory.
Right.
You get so far, and then when you think about, oh, where shall I live?
You go back home.
You go back home to a certain extent. Maybe because people by naturally would know that because of driving through it on their way back to their visit their families or whatever, they would know the area. But you know, for me, I've always lived or worked in the northeast quadrant of. My house now is right in the middle. But I've always had my studios out this way. And so I think there is an element of that must affect.
Mm.
I mean, the big schism in London, I find, is between west and east.
Right.
And I, you know, where I have a bit of a nosebleed when I go east of or west of Marble Arch. There's a certain feeling of sense of entitlement that kind of annoys me about it. And you have the feeling that everybody who lives in West London takes it for granted that they're quite well off. Whereas anybody who's well off in East London kind of goes, oh, I've done all right, haven't I? You know, which I think there's probably just as many well off people in East London spend it on different things. I don't know. that's just my prejudices. So I do think that, you know, East London, you know, the area has affected my work in some ways, you know, in that the sort of general... unspectacular grimness of it all.
Right, marvellous.
You know, it's not kind of terribly, it's not sort of theatrically poor, it's just kind of not particularly nice, and it's all slightly grubby and slightly bad taste, and, you know, it's not going to be stylishly regenerated like some places. Mm. You know, like I live near Exmouth Market,
yeah.
In off of Rosebery Avenue, and when I first moved in with my wife in 88, you know, it was quite a rundown little market, you know, quite a lot of derelict shops, and now of course it's come and gone really, and now it's established little she street, and it's, you know, interesting to watch that process happen by design or accident. But I can't see a lot of this area. I mean, I sort of see there's pockets of Walthamstow that are quite nice. I mean, Walthamstow Village and that, but Leytonstone, I can't think of anywhere in Leytonstone that was like really. It's been knocked about and never, you know, never really taken in hand. And but sometimes I think the most interesting places are the poor, old, messy places. The word regeneration actually makes me think, oh, there goes the neighbourhood. You know, anything interesting is not going to happen here anymore, because it's like the artists move in. I mean, I think Acme commissioned a study, didn't they? Acme Housing Co-op, they commissioned a study of how artists affect the property.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and I've seen it happen all over London. Mm. I mean, I think the first place Chelsea was probably the first place in the Victorian era, you know, it was seen as a bit of a kind of, you know, now because it's posh as anything, but I think I can remember particularly Wapping. You know, I remember I had an exhibition with the Neo-Naturist in B2 Gallery,
yeah.
And then, you know, with a few months or years of that happening, you know, it was all she flats, you know, and it's a bit of a dead zone now, really. It doesn't seem to have much of a life down there. And
so you're suggesting that the artists move in and then everyone else follows?
Well, just by economics, really, yeah. I mean, artists will move in and they will buy naturally, you know, the services will spring up to, you know, cafes and pubs will become a bit more interesting because, you know, one of the artists say, I'm not really cutting it as a sculptor, I know what I do, but I can cook, I'll open, I'll take over that pub, and before you know it, it's a groovy bistro pub, you know, and then, oh yeah, I do a club night, and then the next thing you know, it's like the hottest club, and then, you know, the next thing you know, it's, oh, it's Hoxton. I mean, Hoxton, you know, it still is, it's a bloody roundabout, you know, and...
But at least you can walk down the road now without going down the potholes, which are...
Yeah, it's got very she in Hoxton, hasn't it? You know, but it's amusing.
Yeah. So in terms of the work you're producing currently, you feel that they're pretty... It's not a million miles away from what you were doing before? Or...
No, just better. It'd be horrible if it was worse. But, yeah, I mean, I do the same. I've just become more refined. You know, I don't... I haven't... I think this idea of progression slightly can be really counterproductive in art. I mean, I think I do different sorts of work because I do different sorts of when I go into a different medium, I don't try to do what on the pots what I do in print or in metal. I don't try to replicate it.
Mm.
I make my version of metal sculpture, my version of a print.
Mm.
I think the mistake many artists make is they try to sort of carry their signature style across all the materials, but they don't take into account the limitations of the different materials quite often. I've set up seeing prints that are kind of like their paintings light, you know. Whereas I approach a print as it is the finished artwork. It is not a subsidiary of.
Mm.
So, but the pots, they're like very refined versions of what I did 20 years ago. Mm. Yeah, I've just got better at it.
Mm.
Yeah, my attitudes have changed, and I'm not so willfully obscure anymore. Yeah, I don't mind being understood now.
Right.
I think a lot of teenagers and young people, they kind of labour, because I don't think they understand themselves, so that they make it very hard to understand themselves, because they're kind of, it's all going on. They're in a soup. I think I was definitely in the soup until I was 30.
But I was thinking of sort of like, there's something sort of quite comic and tragic about the protest to a degree. There's something funny about it. There's something humorous about what they did and the way they did it.
Yeah, well, that was good.
And there's also something slightly tragic about it as well.
Well, tragic in that, you know, it was a doomed thing from the word go. But I think, you know, they all enjoyed the ride. I expect everybody looks back on it fondly on the whole, don't they?
Mm.
Yeah.
Some people maybe not quite so much as others.
Well, no, maybe they haven't had such a good life. Depends if their life's got better or worse since then, didn't it? I mean, my life could have gone in a completely different direction. I could have, you know, not married someone with a nice house in central London, and my career could have gone down the pan, which I expect is more likely to have happened to artists who were around the time than what's happened to me, which has been very fortunate.
Mm.
So, yeah, but I look back on it. I mean, I wouldn't want to go, you know, I don't want to live in Leinster again. But it was interesting in that kind of riot going on down the road kind of way.
In terms of the artists, and you mentioned about open studios, did you take part in the Whitechapel?
The only woven studios I took part in were really at Carpenter's Road.
Right.
I found them a rather dispiriting experience on the whole. Because you sort of put together, you know, and people traipse round. By the time they've got to your studio, it's like the 38th studio that's in that evening. They poke their head round the door and go, and then they go out. It's not the best fun.
But in terms of lots of them, having other artists living around you.
Yeah, I miss that. I miss having someone to have a cup of coffee with. Which that was more at Carpenter's Road than Dyer's Hall Road.
Right.
I do miss having someone in the locality that I could help me lift something or have a cup of coffee. Because I'm stuck here on my own, really. I've got to go now.
Yeah. That's great.